So what we're supposed to do now, I was just instructed by Venerable Ajahn Amaro, is a kind of open mic conversation among many people who had time with and were taught by Lungpa Cha, to share stories or swap recollections and so forth. But I think before we do that, I'd like to ask us to do a simple chant just to get ourselves back in our bodies in the room, if we might. Of course, Ajahn Chah had us do lots of chanting in the morning and the evening. It was a very lovely thing. And there are some very long and moving chants now translated into English, so we could do a whole afternoon chanting it would take. But because we have other things to do as well, this chant won't be quite as long. I think maybe we can even take the mics out of this, and so we can pass them. When I came back to see Lungpa Cha, Ajahn Chah, in Bangkok, sometime in the 80s, he had been in the hospital and very, very sick for a period of time. And he was recovering. He was in this monastery outside of Bangkok. And I was making one of my periodic visits back to Thailand and went to see him. And he looked much older and weaker and so forth. But there was still this bright spirit about him even in that. And I bowed and paid my respects, and we talked a bit, and I was looking at him, and I said, you know, and he talked about how many months he'd been in the hospital and so forth, and I said to him, well, you know, you kept saying from day one, you kept talking about old age and sickness and death, and old age and sickness and death and suffering, and the First Noble Truth and so forth, so I guess this is just it. And he looked at me and he said, don't you say that so lightly, old age, sickness, and death. You know? Yeah, I was saying it the way a young person says it, you know, like it's theory or something like that. Don't you say that so lightly. Anyway, so it's just time for us to tell stories or talk or share as we do among ourselves. Please. Anybody? Joseph.
This perhaps is an example. My sister Gail Kappel is here with us, come down from a group from Seattle in Canada. And we on the trip in 1979, we stopped in Massachusetts first and then went out and spent 2 weeks with my family in Seattle, and which is a very memorable visit. We spent time actually in my parents' home. Paul was with us as well. And then we traveled up to Canada for a couple of days. But one of the kind of heartwarming stories is my grandmother was still alive at that time, and my mother and father had been to visit me in Thailand. So they were familiar with the custom, and she'd kind of come to terms with not hugging me and the whole kind of thing about the proximity and respectful distance, as it were, between a monk and even his own mother, which I think has gotten relaxed over the years and in the privacy of appropriate places. But we're arriving in the airport from Massachusetts, and my whole family, including my grandmother, was there, and my mother had versed her in that, you know, Mom, you can't touch him. And, you know, that was the message, and my mother made it very clear to her. And so we come out of the terminal, or where we, I think they have this the kind of monorail type thing that brings you in, and where they were waiting. And so here's this very dignified Thai monk. He carried a cane with him for a lot of reasons, but one, he had some instability in his failing health. But he was always very dignified that he walked and he would stand. You might see some of these photos of him standing, and this incredible dignity and presence when he stands. And so we're arriving, and I've got, you know, his gear and my gear over my shoulders. And so I see my family. I just kind of see them off in the distance. And then I see this little old lady just kind of make a beeline for me. And you know, it's Granny. She comes right for me and just right into my arms. And so here I'm with the gear and Ajahn Chah and my grandmother in my arms. So I'm holding my grandmother, and I just look over at him, and I said, you know, Lumpa, this is my grandmother. And he just kind of looking and you know, kind of taking it all in. Then my mother walks up, and she says, Mother, I told you you couldn't hug him. So, needless to say, there was a wee bit of jealousy there, but she eventually got her hug. And she's got plenty of them since then, so it was nice because it was very touching. We went up to visit Mount Rainier and took him up to the top of Mount Rainier. And, of course, there's snow year-round on Mount Rainier. And he loved to travel around. He loved to see things, and he especially loved to see things in nature. And Mount Rainier is a very impressive mountain. So we drove up and got to the top of Rainier, and this was like end of May, you know, late May, so it was spring and the sun was out, but the top of Mount Rainier is still quite chilly. So we got out of the car, and he wanted to kind of walk around a bit where you park your cars. Then we could see people, they take little expeditions up to the summit of Rainier, and we could see people walking up there. And I was totally freaking out, you know, snow. I hadn't seen snow in 8 years, and I had my sandals off, and I, you know, ran up in the snow barefooted, and I was like totally just kind of loving this cold weather. But he'd been out for about 5 minutes in this chilly air, and he says, Pabakro, Yom Lao, Pukani, Yom Lao, which translates as, Pabakro, I surrender. This mountain is too much for me. So he went back in the car while I did out, went out and did my kind of crazy thing barefoot in the snow, playing the kind of ascetic from Thailand. Came back into the car, and we headed back down and getting things warmed up. And I think we were, him and I were in the back, mother and father, and Gail was along. And my mother, we were coming by one of the rest stops there, and turned. She says, well, does Lumpa need to stop to the bathroom? So I said, you know, Lumpa, do you need to go to the bathroom? He says, how can I go to the bathroom? My whole system is frozen up. He says. Needs to thaw out first. So I could go on, but I want to pass the mic. No. It'll come back, I'm sure.
What are we talking about?
Open mic.
I was also on that trip, and there were a lot of incredible moments when he was outside of the monastic environment. He was essentially on vacation for maybe the second time since I'd known him. But I feel more like talking about the last year of his illness before he stopped speaking. And I went back to Thailand about 4 years after I disrobed, and I didn't know anything about the illness until I spoke to Jack before I was leaving, and he told me but I think it was just when I arrived in Bangkok that somebody told me he had surgery, and he was staying around Bangkok with Ajahn Pabakro as his attendant. At that time, I finally found him, which was quite an undertaking, and he had slowed down a lot, but he was still pretty much the same old Lumpa, just moving slower. And occasionally you could see he was just too exhausted to talk to people, but I would go up to Ubon, to the forest monasteries, and then come back, pass through Bangkok every 2 or 3 months. I'd have to be renewing my visa and leaving the country, and so I would go to see him. And the second time he was in quite poor condition and could just barely talk and focus, and it was quite alarming or shocking or sad to see. And then I'd go back a month later, and he'd be all bright-eyed and full of beans and making fun of me again, and so I knew he was feeling better. And then the next time he'd be not so well, and then they had said he needed about 6 months to recover from his surgery, and then I think I saw him just about 6 months, and he just seemed like the old Lumpa, and it was a kind of dreamlike quality to all this, that he would be so different every time, and you'd wonder, you know, what was really going on, and was I remembering things right from the last time I saw him? And this time in Bangkok, he was just luminous and very relaxed, and it just felt very nice to be around him. It was a very happy feeling, just like none of this illness was a problem anymore. And then he prepared to go back to the monastery, and then he went downhill again, and so I went ahead to the monastery, and then he came a couple of weeks later, and he was in very bad condition. I think he never really bounced back from that one, and then shortly after he stopped talking, and then is when the royal family's doctors came up to see him and asked to bring him to Bangkok for thorough examinations, and this was when I was leaving, so I saw him there at the hospital in Bangkok, and remember him coming out of the room, and he had to be supported when he walked, and you weren't sure if he really knew who you were or was really focused on anything that was going on around him anymore. And having done hospice work, I thought, you know, he's got the look of a dying person, and probably, you know, a few months, a year at most. And I was leaving the country, so it was very heartrending to think I was never going to see him again, and probably I would never hear his voice again, because it seemed like he'd stopped speaking. And then, of course, he fooled us all by living for almost another 10 years. And I visited a few times over those years, and mostly just it was paying my respects to his body. And they would wheel him outside, and the monks, Ajahn Basano would take the monks to go do chanting in front of him. And I mean, you saw his body, but it was hard to think that this was Ajahn Chah. Yet he, and at one point they say he has cancer, he'll be gone in 6 months, and he has this, he has that, and famous psychics were doing predictions, and the best doctors in Thailand, 6 months, he'll be gone, and he stayed around. And I didn't go to see him all that often. I felt like Ajahn Chah was more in the forest, in the monastery where I was staying. He was there in the practice, and it wasn't all that necessary to go see his body every day. And I think that's, you know, that's probably the way he would have preferred it. I always thought of him as somebody with another trick up his sleeve, and it seems like the way he lingered on was a great gift of training to people. The Sangha came together amazingly, and monks learned to be nurses and round-the-clock care, and doctors came out every morning to check his vital signs, and they built a special kuti for him. People made enormous donations, and it felt like this last training he was giving people. And he'd often spoken, you know, what will happen after I die? How are you guys going to practice if I'm not here to remind you? And I think there was a sense among many of us that things wouldn't hold together, that people just weren't that committed without Lumpur around to goad them and, you know, shame them into not disrobing. And those last years, I think it brought the Sangha together in a very major way and kept people on the ball and working together and serving the Master in a very devoted and a very touching way, very touching. And as a layperson coming back with sort of new eyes, the whole thing was very touching. Just seeing people offer food to monks, because after, when you're a monk, after a while you just come to expect it. You know, here I am. Where's my food? This is, you expect it every day in a country like Thailand. And then you go out and you have to earn your keep, and you want Thai curry. Okay, go to a restaurant and you know, a couple of dishes and rice and tax and tip, and you're out, you know, $20 something. And hey, in Thailand, I used to turn these things down, which you'd be in Bangkok, you have bags and bags full of curries. Well, which one will I choose today? And now you can barely pick two, and once every month, maybe, or every few months. So to see people offering this kind of generosity, and the way the lay people came to the monasteries and the way that monasteries were open, it was all very moving. The last few times I saw Ajahn Chah, it was all a very moving thing, and you wonder, you know, what was he up to when this was going on. I kind of see it as his last teaching, or his last gift or trick or whatever. So I'll pass the microphone.
Just listening to Paul speaking then reminded me of a story of that time after Ajahn Chah had his stroke and was paralyzed, and occasionally people from the monasteries in England would go to Thailand and spend a few weeks or a few months there. And on one of those visits, Ajahn Ananda was traveling with Ajahn Sumedho. Ananda was the second monk in the community in England, and later the abbot of Chidhurst Monastery. One of the most sought after tasks in the monastic routine was getting to be one of Ajahn Chah's nurses during the this period. It was, had four monks round the clock nursing him, and so Ajahn Ananda took on very gladly took on the task of doing some nursing for Ajahn Chah while he was on this trip through Thailand. And like Paul was saying, Ajahn Chah always had tricks up his sleeve, and he was always like one pace ahead of everybody. And so during this time Ajahn Ananda was nursing him, he had become interested in healing, like kind of faith healing, kind of hands-on healing. And so during the night shift, he was on the sort of 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock shift in Ajahn Chah's kuti, and he thought, kind of during the still hours of the night, well, maybe I should do some healing on him. That would be good. Maybe that'll help. And you should bear in mind that by this time Ajahn Chah was completely paralyzed, and up to a point he could move one of his hands for a little bit, and then later on he even lost that. So he was basically immobile and had been for a long, long time. So our dear friend Ananda was standing over him, kind of concentrating and holding his hands over Ajahn Chah's reclining body, and kind of concentrating and putting forth his feelings of kindness and sending forth some energy through his hands to Ajahn Chah. And then he swears it was not a hallucination, but the master sat up in bed, opened his eyes, looked Ananda straight in the eye, didn't say anything, but it was as if to say, who do you think is in need of help here? with his gaze for a few moments, till Ananda had really got the point, then closed his eyes and lay back down again. So this is a very substantial silent teaching to Ananda. Yesterday someone was asking questions about Ajahn Chah's some of his defilements, and one of the reasons why people thought he was so wise. I remember some people coming to ask him one time, saying, well, you must have studied the Abhidhamma so deeply, you must have studied the scriptures so extensively to become so have such deep understanding, such kind of all-encompassing comprehension of the Buddha Dhamma. And he said, oh, no, I didn't get any of this from the books. If I've developed any wisdom, it's because I had such gigantic defilements. And so he was tremendously restless. He had a lot of anger, very angry personality. He was doubt was his one of his major problems, and sexual desire, voluminous lust. The only one of the five hindrances he wasn't blessed with in full measure was dullness and sleepiness, because the others were all blazing so furiously that that one didn't get a look in. So I thought I might pass on a few of Ajahn Chah's stories about his wranglings with sexual desire. And the first story comes from a time when he was had started as a meditation monk and was deeply determined to try and get some kind of handle on his sexual desire. So he made the resolution that he wouldn't look at a woman for the whole of the 3 months Rains Retreat. No visual contact whatsoever. He would restrain his eyes, and when any time one arms round, or any time any woman came to the monastery, he would look away, would look at the ground, would not let himself see a female person at all. Because he saw how strong the kind of the impulse was to look, and the effect that would have on his mind. So, as you might have got a sense, he had some pretty awesome powers of resolution, determination. And for the whole 3 months, he managed to keep his resolve that he managed not to look a single time at any woman. And so, come the end of the rains retreat, he was thinking, pretty good. I did pretty well there. It's pretty impressive. And so he said, okay, well, now let's see what the results of my practice is. So he thought, okay, well, when some of the village women come to the monastery, I'll deliberately look and see how completely I have have cut through this problem. And so he then described that when after the alms round, when some of the women from the village came to bring food to the monastery, he deliberately kind of looked up and let himself see that this form of this woman coming into the moving across the sala. And then the people who were with him said, "Well, so then what happened?" He went quiet for a moment and said, "It was like being hit by lightning." I was a complete mess. You know, it was like I lost it totally. But he also said, "So I realized, but that did teach me that that's not the way. Just by restraining it on its own is not the path out of the problem. That there's it has to be worked with some understanding." A couple of other stories on the same theme to sort of. Will extend and then complete the picture. One of the things that an incident that took place some years later, he was staying at the branch monastery or the monastery of one of his teachers, Lumpo Kinari. And just to give you a sense of the depth of his sexual desire, what he could go to, he found himself at one point hallucinating, that what he was hallucinating was he was surrounded by visions of female sexual organs everywhere he looked, and he was in a constant state of sexual arousal for about 10 days, as the story goes, and that as he recounted it, when he did walking meditation, he had to hold his robe hitched up round his waist so that accidents wouldn't happen. But he was determined. He said, "I'm just going to keep working with it. I'm not going to give in. I'm going to stay with this because all that arises." He said, "All I could stay with was all that arises passes away. This has to come to an end." No pun intended. And then later on, he said, when someone asked him, "Well, what do you think that was?" And he said, he thinks it was, or he might have been playfully speaking of it. He said it was probably that all of the wives that he'd had in previous lives, it was kind of visions of their nakedness reappearing before him as his final last hurrah of working with sexual desire. But he made it, as we've been hearing over this weekend, he did have incredible powers of resolution, determination, and he made it through, he stayed with it, and saw that experience through to its end without kind of pushing it away or without being swamped by it. He just kept his resolve and kept contemplating what that was, despite the kind of incredible intensity of that experience. Also, as we've been sensing, he was a very earthy person, had a very hands-on sense for human nature, and was not afraid of telling people how it is. And at Barre, Massachusetts, when he was teaching there in 1979, during a questions and answers session, and probably the story has altered a bit during the telling, but it's a good story anyway. So was that during a questions and answers session, somebody asked Ajahn Chah about sexuality and whether one can practice as a householder, and is it necessarily an obstruction to be involved in a romantic sexual relationship with another person? And surely, and the way the question was phrased was intimating that, well, surely one can look at sexual activity as some kind of the sacred dance of positive and negative, and the song of the cosmos, and the interplay of the male and female energies of the universe, and the sacred marriage, and la-di-da-di-da. So casting it into this very noble and sort of mystical form. And I guess Joseph was translating at the time, probably. And it might have one of these two. And anyway, Ajahn Chah had the question translated to him, and he pondered for a moment. And then he took his finger and then he put it in his nose. Started picking his nose. In a very graphic and extended way. Until everybody in the room was had definitely got the point of what he was referring to. And finally, when everyone was sort of rolling on the floor, rather than the kittisaro and the squirrel mode, you know, everyone was fully got the point, and everyone understood what he was getting at. He said, he kind of pulled his finger out, and then said, "There's nothing more to it than that, except what your mind adds to it," which was pretty. Direct teaching. But it was also the kind of thing he was not afraid to put across. If that was his understanding, that was his gift, was to demystify and to say put that possibility in front of people as a way of opening a door of understanding, seeing that experience in a different way.
A different story I want to tell of Lungpa Cha, and I tell it because most of the people who are sitting in, certainly in the front row here, have at some time or another been an abbot, or an abbess of some monastery or other. And when Lungpa Cha came to, Massachusetts in 1979 for that visit, one of the things we did was to take him to Spencer Abbey, which is one of the three biggest Trappist monasteries in the country. There's Merton's, Gethsemane, a couple of others. And so when we went to the monastery, the abbot, who is a very beautiful man, Father Thomas Keating, was there to greet us along with most of the monks. There were like 60 or 70 monks who lived in silent, celibate, very kind of austere in a certain way lifestyle. And Ajahn Chah went up to Thomas Keating, to the abbot, and he kind of patted him on the back, and he said, "I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I feel so sorry for you." And I was translating, I think, and Thomas Keating was kind of looking bewildered, like, "Why is he so sorry? Why is he so sorry for me?" And then Ajahn Chah looked around at all the monks, and he said, "You know, being an abbot is such a difficult role." He said, "It's so hard to be the abbot. Everybody wants things, and there's always these conflicts, and you know where they all end up? They end up on the abbot." He said, "You should really treasure this man. You should value this man. It's so hard to be an abbot." And Thomas Keating's smile got bigger and bigger and bigger as he stood there. He said, "You have no idea how hard it is to be an abbot." And Keating is smiling, and "You have to really take care of this man," and so forth. And it was a really wonderful introduction to the monastery. Ajahn Pasano, do you have any?
Yeah, there's a couple stories that have been stimulated. One is around Ajahn Chah's because he put tremendous effort into his practice, and but sometimes he was just he would, you know, it wasn't as if he was successful all the time with his defilements. And I think that's one of the things that inspired all of us, is that and he never made it like he was always perfect, and that he was successful all the time. And I remember him telling the story one time of him being in the monastery. This is still in his early days as a monk, and he was just thinking about food all the time, which is the vocation of a young monk, is thinking about food all the time. It was one of the big sort of loops of the mind that go around food. So he finally, one day, he couldn't stand any longer. He went to the little village shop that sold noodles, and just before noon, and he said, walked in, he said, "Close the doors. Today I'm eating noodles." He had 9 bowls. I asked him, you know, "How many bowls?" He had 9 bowls. 9 bowls of noodles. So, just the not always successful, but it's you know, to see that to keep working at it.
When I went to Thailand to see, I spoke yesterday about meeting Ajahn Chah in England and how that had deeply impacted and impressed me. And then I had a very strong pull towards going, wanting to go to Thailand to try and be in the monastery and just explore further what the lifestyle that Ajahn Chah lived. And I had the opportunity, after about 9 months or so I was in India, I had an opportunity to go to Burma, and on the way we had to go through Bangkok to get visas to go up to Burma. And the visas were delayed, and I thought, well, this is my opportunity now. I couldn't go on my own steam because I was with a group of people that had sponsored me, so it was hard for me just to sort of trek out from the group. But as the visas were delayed, I decided that this would be an opportunity to go up to the northeast and to see Ajahn Chah. And so to do that, one has to get an overnight train from Bangkok. And my friend and I were going to go together. And while the rest of the party waited down in one of the hotels, first-class hotels in Bangkok, just swimming and laying out in the sun and chilling out from the time of in the ashram in India. And when I got to the station for the overnight train, my friend arrived, and she just announced that she wasn't going to go. I said, well, what's the problem? She said, no. She said, I can't go up there. There's communists up there. And then she said, no, there's mosquitoes up there. I can't go up there. And so I said, well, you know, but I've got to go. I've just got to go and see Ajahn Chah. I'll meet you back in the hotel in a while. So I got the overnight train, and I was very nervous. Got off the next morning and then walked up to a taxi and just said, Ajahn Chah. And, and so he knew exactly where to take me. And eventually I found Ajahn Chah in this, not in Wat Bar Phom, but the small monastery on the Mekong River. I don't know which monastery it was. And I went in and paid, got some offerings, went to bow, paid respects, and then he asked me about my meditation. And he said, and I told him I've been in India and I've been doing this kind of different practices, and he just said something that he said to many Westerners. He said, well, you know, you're just like you're going around everywhere, and what you really need to do is just look in one place, look in your own heart. And then he said, go off and, he didn't say go off and be with Ajahn Sumedho, it was impossible. He said, go and be with Kumpha, Meche Kumpha, who was the first Western nun ever to live in the monastery, Wat Bar Phong, on Wat Bun Wai. She was an American woman, and she spent 5 years as a Meche, which means white mother, so, as a nun. And so I went off, and Kumpha was very inspired at that time. She was very devoted to Ajahn Chah. She was a very inspiring woman and a great practitioner, and I spent time with her and felt very moved to be with her. But eventually I had to leave the monastery. I didn't have, for us as women, it wasn't so it's easy to have the kind of intimate contact that we've heard that the men had access to, so it was more difficult. So one had to learn sort of proximity, not being able to be right close, but once removed. And so after a while I left and came back, eventually got back to England and decided to wrap up my affairs to go back to Thailand so that I could go and live in the monastery. I decided I wanted to live in the monastery. By which time Chithurst had opened. So I thought, well, I'll just go and visit Chithurst before I go back to Thailand. And of course, ended up, in the end, it wasn't necessary to go to Thailand. I could stay in Chithurst. But I always remember Kumpha being such an inspiration. And then after 2 years, Ajahn Sumedho arranged a visit to take some Westerners in 81 to Wat Bar Phong. And he took some women that were interested in the nun's life, and the first other Sister Chandasiri, who had ordained with me, and another nun. And he was also talking very much about Kung Fa and how inspiring she was. And so they went and arrived in Wat Bun Wai, ready to meet this very inspiring Western nun. And meanwhile, in between my first meeting her and then Ajahn Sumedho's visit back to Thailand from England, Khunpho had become converted to a reborn Christian in a major way. And she was really very rabid about it. And you know, there are many reasons maybe why that happened. It's not the discussion today, but it was very disturbing and quite distressing to see this someone that had been so devoted come, you know, turn around so much. And people got very upset about it, and because she was, like, in a way very keen to try and show people the light, and in the way of doing that was putting down Ajahn Chah. It was very painful to experience this. And then at one point Ajahn Sumedho told us that he went to Ajahn Chah to say, you know, how upset he was about this, that Khunpho was, you know, had become this kind of raving reborn, and was quite, you know, was quite derogatory about Ajahn Chah, and was not inspiring, you know, the women that he had brought, and he was quite upset about it. And Ajahn Chah just looked at him and said, well, maybe she's right. I really like that. I really like that so much. And then the other story I just wanted to say, I got the opportunity to share with you, and it's been so wonderful to share these stories, which was another meeting I had with Ajahn Chah was when I had come back to England, and he came in 79. And I'd been in Thailand and I hadn't quite got myself into robes yet, and I'd gone to see him, and he basically said, why did you come back? You know, why did you come back to England? Why didn't you stay in Thailand? And I came out with some big story about my Western karma, and he didn't look impressed. And anyhow, he was staying in a small wooden hut in a Buddhist center outside of Oxford, and a small wooden kuti. And I decided that I'd bring my friend to come and meet this master. And I didn't know much about monks' etiquette at that time. And so I dragged her along to this kuti and just knocked on the door. I didn't know about making appointments and arrangements and not being able to enter monks' quarters and so on. I just came up and knocked on the door. And Ajahn Chah opened the door and invited me in. And there was Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Sumedho, and I think another monk, I can't remember who it was, sitting in there. And before, every contact I'd had with Ajahn Chah, he was always really humorous, light, very, very loving, very radiant, very joyous. It was fun just to sit there in his presence, the few contacts I'd had. But when I sat down, I felt like I was suddenly had entered the lion's den. I started to feel very nervous. And I sort of looked at the door, and the door was closed, and I was sitting there. And he started asking me about my meditation, the sort of way he would start with most Westerners, how's your meditation? And so I kind of rambled about something. And then halfway through, he said, do you understand the teaching on non-self? And I went, yes. Yes, I know about that one. And so I started to talk about what I thought I understood on the teaching of anatta, of non-self. And the more I was talking about it, the more the sense of self started to grow and grow and grow. And I felt like I was just like this huge self sitting in the room. And the more empty and empty and empty he became. And I had this feeling like I was walking the plank. And I didn't quite know where to go and how to stop. But eventually I just petered out, and there was just like this big red balloon of self sitting there. And I just stopped. And he was just sitting there, and, you know, it was like everyone could see me. And he said something in Thai, and Ajahn Sumedho refused to translate. And so he said it again, and Ajahn Sumedho leaned over to me and he said, he says you're very ignorant. It was like someone just pricked the balloon, and I just went, little puddle on the floor. And then he gave a really beautiful teaching on non-self. And this is what I was saying yesterday. He didn't dilute anything, you know, for whether because one was a lay person or a young person or a woman, or it was just very direct. And my friend and I, we came out of that and we just went into a burst of giggles. You know, it was like this reaction. We just went hysterical. And I remember that as feeling very graced to have received such a teaching from Ajahn Chah. I'm still trying to ponder it.